broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to all of our listeners, and happy Friday to everyone here in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So this weekend is Grand Prix weekend.
Woo. That's exciting.
A lot happening.
Is anyone actually going to Grand Prix?
I wouldn't mind.
Yeah?
I wouldn't mind. I've never actually been to a Grand Prix in Melbourne, even though, how long has it been here for now? About 15, 20 years.
I've got to say, I have never been myself either. Has anyone else? Have you guys?
I've been a couple of times.
I've only been as far as to stick my head over the fence. I used to live in an apartment across the road.
Well, you'd probably never want to go again.
Yeah, not really.
Living opposite?
A lot of congestion and headaches for the 6 weeks before, while it's being set up, and the 3 or 4 weeks after, when it's been packed down. So a bit of an inconvenience for local residents, but I always loved the vibe. Yep. I still love the vibe of it.
Yeah.
Even though my plan this weekend is to get out of town.
Yeah, you're going camping again, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah.
Camping.
Again.
I'm loving it. Again.
Oh, loving the camping. Yeah, getting absolutely. Back to nature.
Yeah, back to nature and family time and time away from phone reception.
Oh, I thought it was time away from someone else.
Well, yes, I am going camping without my wife, with
this
my
is
daughter.
Number two, Louis.
This is the second time in 2 weeks.
I think she's a smart woman.
Well,
send you on some bonding time with Gwen.
Exactly.
But this is a family camping trip, though, isn't it?
It is family. Parents, yes, so. I'm going with parents and brothers and sisters.
It'll be lovely.
Yeah. It's a whole gang. And if all goes well, I'll be going again in 2 weeks' time.
Wow.
Yeah. Right into it.
Excellent.
Trying to squeeze in some camping trips
while the
weather is good.
Yeah, I can't believe actually we're already, midway through March. I just woke up this morning and thought, my goodness, this year is actually flying.
Is there something significant about today's date?
Today's date? Yes. Well, there's a couple of things that are going on today. It is our wedding anniversary.
Happy 5 years.
Yeah, and it is also, those history buffs, the Ides of March.
The what of what?
The Ides of March. Does anyone know their history, Roman history?
Not intimately, but I'm aware of.
Beware the Ides of March, as they say. Today is the day that Julius Caesar, back on 44 BC, was murdered in the Senate of Rome, where he's, obviously, I think Caesar perhaps got too big of a head and the senators didn't like exactly where he was taking Rome. But today is the Ides of March. So beware the Ides of March.
Interesting. Watch out, Joel.
Watch your back. If you feel a point in your back.
Yes.
Look out.
My little Cicero.
Hey, guys, I saw something yesterday coming back to the Grand Prix about the driver's salaries. So from an Australian perspective, Daniel Ricciardo has moved teams, and a lot of people said, oh, it's for bigger money, and it was touted that it was close to $50 million. But there's actually a summary that's come out on all the drivers' salaries, the disparity is significant.
Oh, right. So maybe the drivers need a union or something like
possibly.
That.
Possibly. Well, look, just to give you some insight, so Lewis Hamilton, the current world champion, he's the highest paid, and his salary is down at $57 million a year.
Down.
Not too down at $57
That's
million.
Terrible.
Up at $57 million.
He's listed down at $57 million. And then the other driver that's won recent world championship, Sebastian Vettel's the next highest paid at $45 million. Daniel Ricciardo comes in third at $17
million. Gosh. She's doing it tough.
It's not a lot of money.
They were saying, though, that Ricciardo got his back up, didn't he, earlier this week about the fact that some English paper said he was up at $47 million.
Yeah.
That, do we not believe that figure?
I think that might be the contract over a few years.
There we go.
Misreporting.
Okay. Misreporting.
But the interesting thing when I looked at the table was that the driver with the lowest salary, and I'm not familiar with all the drivers, but it was actually quite a low amount by comparison. So you'd think if there's these top three are in the tens of millions, you'd think, well, they're all going to be on the millions because there's only like 15 to 20 drivers.
Yep.
But Alexander Albon, who drives for Toro Rosso,
right,
salary of $170,000.
Jeez.
Oh, really? Right.
Massive difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm. And there's some others that are, you know, the next one's up $180,000 and it gradually works its way up. And, you know, the majority are over $1 million. Mm. But, you know, from $55 million down to $170,000 for doing the same job in effect.
Yeah.
That's performance for you, isn't
well,
it?
Well, let's be honest. He's probably, you know, not getting the danger money that the others are because he's at the back with no, you know.
He's a straggler.
Yeah. In a car that only goes half the pace.
Yeah, he's got a clear track to deal with.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He's just got to make sure he watches the mirrors so that the lappers don't, you know, take him out.
That's true incentive, though, to do well in the racing, isn't it? Just to get a salary like that.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
I think it's your entry level.
You've got to get to one of the big teams, though, where they can afford it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. And when a new driver comes onto the scene, like Daniel Ricciardo just seemed to come from nowhere. It's not like he was in the Formula One for a few years at that lower team. He just sprung into Red Bull Racing straight away from seemingly nowhere. It's like suddenly, bang, okay, Daniel Ricciardo's here and he's one of the best.
Yep.
He just got elevated straight into the top level of F1.
Well, and that seemed to be the case with his teammate from last year that's taken over as the leader at Red Bull, that Max Verstappen, who's only young.
Right.
You know, he seemed to appear from nowhere, but, you know, he's now one of the top contending drivers.
Right. Joel, we did watch a documentary on Ricciardo, though, and he seems like quite a down-to-earth kind of a guy. So.
He is, isn't he? He's that good old Aussie, you know, down-to-earth, larrikin, but just a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Just genuinely
hasn't
nice
gone
guy.
To his head from what we could see. So.
He's a Perth boy.
He is a Perth boy.
He's an Eagles fan. Good on him.
One thing I don't think I could do is the shoey, though. I don't know about the idea of drinking out of a sweaty shoe.
No.
Evens for $57 million?
Look. I'd compromise on that.
It's probably really good champagne. Yeah.
It'd dull down the taste of shoe. So.
That's right.
Well, look, I think we'll kick along actually with Brett, because I know that you've got a few topics to cover off today. Considering you've already started, let's get into some more.
Yeah, why not? But the very first one is actually a response to last week. Now, Louis, you set a bit of a challenge.
I did, Brett. I'm very keen to hear. And what I asked was, I know on the stock market there is something called the smart money index. There's certain times of day that you know that your average punters and day traders are active in the stock market, and later in the day it's really only the people who really know what's going on who are investing. So the trades that happen towards the end of the day is called the smart money index, and that gets measured. Is there any kind of such index in the property market? Is there some way to see what your really skilled or big buying investors and big selling investors are doing?
Short answer, no.
Oh, okay.
Right, there
Not
you go.
Something that we could say is directly comparable to that.
Okay.
And it's probably because the property market moves a lot slower, nowhere near the volume of transactions. It's not a day-to-day sort of thing. But I had to think about, okay, well, what is there that could be comparable? And the only sort of gauge that I could say has some sort of measurement to it is probably what's known as the property clock. Okay, so for people that aren't familiar with the property clock, it's basically a graphic system that was introduced a few years ago from a few different property experts and analysts to talk about how the property cycle works and trying to give people an understanding of where we're at in what stages of the cycle. And every cycle's different, obviously, but they all seem to have similar things where there's a peak and then there's obviously a bottom. And then in between, there's the declining market between the peak and the bottom and the rising market between the bottom and the peak.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the way we talk about the clock, if you think of 12 o'clock being the peak of the market, 6 o'clock being the bottom of the market, and so obviously the decline is as you're going from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock to the bottom at 6, and then a rising market from 7 to 11. And sometimes, you know, there's obviously metrics around, you know, volumes of sales, price movement and everything else that helps indicate when a market is at what stage of this clock. So it's not necessarily about the smart money index as such, but what we do know is that the seasoned property investors and the wealthy people that do buy lots of property, whether it's for development or make big substantial transactions tend to do most of it at that lower end around the bottom of the market.
Mm. Is that shifting though? Have you seen a shift over the years, or has it remained consistent the whole way through?
Look, the shift is how long these cycles last. Yeah. So a property clock, you know, we're talking about it, you know, being at 6 to 12, that doesn't mean it runs for a set period of time. Mm. It's just an indication as to where it might be, right, based on metrics. So one property cycle might last for 3 or 4 years, or it could last for 15 years. So there's not really an easy way to say exactly where we're at and how long it will last, but there definitely is some sort of metrics that can tell you, compared to the last peak or compared to the last bottom, where we're likely to be on the clock.
Okay. Mm. Interesting.
So that's a metric. And I thought, look, I'll have a look and see where any market experts are saying we are on the clock as of today.
Yep.
So
because your average punter will be saying we're in heavy decline.
Yes.
Is your average punter saying we're at the bottom?
Well, this isn't the average punter. This is Heron Todd White as a valuer, one of the nation's biggest valuation companies. Okay. So they're using their data and the way they put it on their clock. So they've got two clocks that I've got here, one for houses, one for units. So they've got, so they're saying that there's different markets at different ends of the clock, or at different parts of the clock. So they're not saying that the market as a whole is anywhere. They're just saying, if we look at the clock and they put different regions and locations at different times.
Okay.
So just to give an indication of where they're saying, so the bottom of the market at the moment, so 6 o'clock for houses, they're saying is the likes of Alice Springs, Rockhampton, Toowoomba, Darwin.
Right.
Okay. The only ones featuring at the peak of the market, at the top of the clock, they're saying that Dubbo and Gippsland, Lismore and the Mid-North Coast are at the peak of the market.
Dubbo.
Hmm. So, and the reasons that they give for this is they're looking at clearance rates, days on market, and you know, prices now compared to recent times. So that's the metrics they're using to say where each market is.
Okay.
Okay, so the big markets, though, where do they appear? Well, Melbourne's considered to be at 3 o'clock in a declining market.
Okay.
So not too far away from other commentary we've referenced, where we're in a declining market, maybe haven't bottomed out yet, but on the way down. Sydney's considered to be the same. Perth considered to be further along, sort of about 5 o'clock, so close to the bottom.
Okay.
And Brisbane's considered to be at around sort of 7:30 on its way back up.
Okay.
So they're saying that different parts of the country at different stages on the clock.
Yeah. And that matches up really nicely with the analysis we've been saying.
It's, you know, it's I guess this is a graphical way, and I guess a metrical way of sort of giving this indication and comparing the different markets. Moving to units, though, it's not identical. Very similar. So Melbourne and Sydney are both considered to be around 3 o'clock in units. Brisbane, though, is considered to be at about 4 o'clock in units.
Yeah.
Right. So 7 o'clock in a rising market. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Still a little bit more pain in the apartment market.
Yeah. Well, they just had such an influx of apartments on the market, didn't they? We really saw that with Brisbane.
Significant oversupply.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And funnily enough, there are unit markets that, you know, based on their data, is saying approaching the peak of the market at that 10:30, 11 o'clock. Around Hobart and the Sunshine Coast.
Right, okay.
So it goes to show, as we've sort of discussed previously, there are markets within markets, you know, houses and units, but also regions and areas as well.
Right.
And I guess the other thing, we're always an advocate of, when you're buying property, it's a long-term investment. So therefore, you want to spend time in the market, not try to time the market.
Correct.
So therefore, if you were looking at making an investment and you were trying to time the market, we would assume that the best time to buy is probably around the bottom of the market and as it's starting to rise.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So if you were looking at this, trying to time the market, well, the indication on this clock would be that you're waiting for the markets you like to be either at the bottom, or if you just want to buy something now, you would look at the ones that are at the bottom and look like they're preparing to rise.
I think, like, you know, you were just mentioning that Darwin and you know, is not really doing all that well. Is that now a time to get in for places like that, or is it because it's the, you know, the resource boom has sort of gone from that area? Is that what's caused the decline? What is it?
Look, the challenge we have with going to a market like Darwin is it still doesn't have the depth in the market that a Sydney, Melbourne or Brisbane does.
Yeah.
And typically that means you're always going to be a little bit at the mercy of smaller industries, and jobs can be more volatile where there's not as many employers around.
Mm.
So we're not really seeing that we would take anyone as an investor into Darwin.
What about Rockhampton?
Don't know enough about Rockhampton, to be honest. It's not a market we've analysed.
Yep.
But look, we need to do some analysis. We certainly wouldn't say no because we don't know enough about it. Not sure if I have a look at the clock and see if it's listed anywhere at the moment. Because it's a big enough area that, so it's considered right at the bottom of the market now.
Yeah, right.
For housing. So that's potentially a buying signal if you're in a long-term investor.
Mm.
But to understand whether that's the best market to get into versus another one, don't have enough data.
One of the key things that you need to be careful of when you're thinking about buying real estate is what's your exit strategy.
Mm.
And therefore, you want to be involved ideally in markets where it's easy enough to get out of that property and it's liquid enough and there's enough buyers that are going to be there when the time comes for you wanting to sell. And, you know, a lot of these regional areas, you know, they have some risks around how quickly you can get out of these properties when the time comes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely want a certain amount of depth and volume in the market. But you also want to look at the factors that that market depends on. And you can take a relatively big market like Perth, but you look at the factors that it depends on, and it's very much correlated with the mining industry and how that is performing, not profits-wise, but jobs-wise. When there's lots of jobs in the mining sector because mining is expanding, well, then lots of population is moving to Perth and lots of population of Perth is on rising wages.
Yep.
And then when the reverse is happening, well, then the reverse is happening in the property market as well. So, yes, you can have a market that is still relatively big, but if it's correlated with one of these cyclical industries, well, then your property market is going to have these large rises and these large falls at the end of it, which is not your ideal place to be invested when you're subject to these large cyclical movements.
The only thing I'm curious about is as our population size grows and people can no longer sort of populate Melbourne or Sydney and want to look further afield, is that a market that we should be looking to, you know, like your Rockhamptons or your Darwins? Do you think that that's going
to
shift in time?
And closer to home, our Geelongs and Geelong, our Ballarats.
Yeah. Well, Geelong's sort of seen quite a bit of a boom already.
Definitely. Yep.
You know, but should we be looking further afield? Should you be doing your research on these sort of more regional locations because the future might potentially shift that way?
Yep. I mean, do the research and make sure that there's enough infrastructure, jobs, things that are going to support that local economy, and then there's sound reasons to enter that market.
Okay.
And those regional places in Victoria are still supported by Melbourne. There's
that's right.
Like your Bendigo.
Correct. Yeah. It's not the majority of the population, but there is a relatively large portion of the population that commutes to Melbourne and is supported by Melbourne and its varied industries.
Mm.
And the other part of that scenario, Louis, is that the majority of the time the higher wages are in the capital cities.
Yeah.
So the people that do go and move regionally, there's typically not enough jobs in that town to support all of the population, and the average wage is lower. So a lot of those people do need to commute. So proximity to a major capital is still a good thing to and a key consideration. Now, before we discuss something else, Louis, just to tie up with that smart money index, one other part of it I'll add.
Yep.
There's not a metric and there's not a measurement or any data we can add, but there is a bit of an indicator we have, and we deal with a lot of people in the know, and even architects and some of our town planners and that deal with a lot of wealthy families. So I guess the unknown index, we would say, is when the wealthy families tend to start buying up significant land holdings.
Okay.
That's kind of an inside indicator of the bottom of the market.
Anecdotal evidence.
Anecdotal evidence.
Right.
Yep. Yes. And, okay. And in history, you know, typically it's been when they start to buy, it's typically, well, the, you know, the bottom's here, they're buying now.
Mm.
And that's almost like the indication that the market's about to turn.
Have you got any insights, Brett?
Well, we just listen to the people we know, but it's not put publicly. I mean, there may be some stuff on websites that talks about a significant transaction, but a lot of the time these don't ever hit the media.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Mm. So it's only people we know, agents or architects or people that are dealing with these
types of buyers. What are you hearing at the moment, though?
Some are looking very hard at the moment.
Okay.
Not any significant transactions, but they're actively looking, sensing that there's
might be the start of it. Yeah,
yeah. Mm. Sensing that opportunities are going to be coming.
Right. Interesting insight.
Yep. There's no laws against insider trading in the property market, is there?
Well, there isn't such a thing.
No. There you go. Mm. You got to know the right people,
indeed,
have the right information.
Yep. And look, before we move on to someone else, I want to hog the show for a little bit longer.
Sure.
Major announcement this week that I thought it's about time. Look, not necessarily a direct property announcement, but finally Melbourne's going to get an airport train link.
Really? What happened there?
Yeah.
Isn't it like 2050 or something?
Yeah, it is quite a way. Look, it was all but confirmed last year, but Funnily enough, this week, the state Labor governor got together with the Prime Minister from the Liberal Party.
Right.
And they signed off on the airport rail link for Melbourne.
No. Wow, okay. I can't believe it.
Finally going to happen. So they're saying that construction won't start until around 2022, with completion expected around 2031.
Brett, I thought that would come in the you can't be serious section.
Yeah, yeah.
No, wow. It's amazing. But it's real, so we can be serious.
Well, okay. Yeah.
So the area that I think, if I was to try and say, how would I want to benefit?
2031, okay, yeah.
If
okay.
I was thinking, how would I want to benefit from this as a property investor? Sunshine is going to be the hub. So Sunshine train station is going to be the nearest local station that then directs out to the airport. Mm-hmm. It's already the station that has both the Ballarat and the Geelong lines come through it. And so it is an area that you would okay. think, if you want to have access to a lot of different areas, Sunshine's going to have a lot of activity. It's going to be the hub for a lot of commuting.
Wow. I cannot believe it's taken us that long to even decide on getting a train when, you know, states like Queensland and Brisbane has the train.
Yep.
And don't be fantastic. Disparaging of Brisvegas.
Well, I love Brisbane. I think their airport is absolutely amazing. Like, they're absolutely killing us.
Yep.
Yep.
It's just, I mean, certainly doing a lot of travel for work. I think we're well behind with the services the we're providing.
Well, and we're still, 13, 14 years away from having it.
Yeah, yeah. And we're the, you know, an international hub. Mm. It's incredible.
Just out of curiosity, is the plan train link, is that going to be pretty much like a direct route with only just a couple of small stops along the way, or is it going to be, you know, stop all stations
okay
to
so
the airport?
There's a few things that haven't been whether they have been clarified and I don't know or not. I think the major decision is that they're now going to go ahead and build the line from Sunshine to the airport.
Right, okay.
So the types of services you can get, I would say it'll be no stops between Sunshine and the airport, I would imagine.
Okay, but you'll stop all
stations
because
there's nothing really else along. Yeah, or there's probably going to be an airport express from Southern Cross to Sunshine and then Sunshine onwards.
Okay.
Yeah. And not banging on about how bad our services are, but how long did it even take them to widen the Tellamarine Freeway and get lanes in there so that we could get out to the airport?
That seems to be a permanent work in progress.
It sure does.
Every time I've been out there, there's always roadworks.
Yep. Yeah, true.
I note also in the paper today that the Liberal Party are planning on doing a deal with the Liberal... So the federal government is doing a deal with some of the Victorian Liberal candidates, that are based in Victoria for the federal government, to provide funding once again to the east-west link.
Oh, okay.
If the Liberal Party get voted back into power.
Thanks for that, Brent. And we're now going to just have a short break. We'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and we're back with Joel now. You're going to be speaking to us about the high yield debt market, also known as the junk bond market. Tell us more.
Thank you. Yes, one of the things that I have been wary of, one of the potential risks to the stock market and this current economic cycle that I've been wary of, has been the potential risks around the high yield junk bond market in the United States. So for those people who don't know what the junk bond market is, you have investment grade debt, which is basically anything from AAA all the way down to BBB. And these are S&P Standard and Poor's ratings for the credit quality of the issuer. So those people who are borrowing, and those companies that are borrowing corporate debt, issuing bonds, S&P 500, S&P, Moody's, these are credit rating companies. They come out with a rating that reflects the borrowing strength of the issuer of those bonds.
So does that rating give you comfort that they're highly likely to be able to repay?
Yeah, obviously AAA being the highest rating, there's not many companies that meet that AAA rating in the world, and then all the way down to BBB, which is what we call investment grade.
So in Australia, you'd be talking about companies like Telstra borrowing millions or billions of dollars to run their business.
Correct.
The Woodsides, the BHPs.
Banks, those types of
banks.
Things. Now, the junk bond market or the non-investment grade market or high yield market.
Is that what junk means?
Yeah. are those bonds that are issued by issuers that have, you know, double B ratings or less. Now, the concern is that there has been a huge amount of debt in this market that has been issued and also a huge amount of debt at the BBB level, which is investment grade, that could become what they call fallen angels that go down to double B rating and become high yield bonds. Now, the issue here is that if that happens because of a economic event or a deterioration in the ability of the corporates to meet those debt obligations, then all of a sudden you have a huge amount of selling pressure potentially because you have investment managers who are, you know, are supposed to be investing according to a mandate that can only invest in investment grade bonds. So if one or two or, you know, if a number of these BBB rated issuers, and there's around about 40% of all issues at the moment are sitting at BBB rating. If we have a wave of defaults or, you know, downgrades, then all of a sudden that could be exacerbated because you see a number of these triple Bs falling down to double Bs and the investment managers are being forced to sell those bonds, you know, into a market that traditionally doesn't have a huge amount of liquidity or anywhere near the liquidity as of investment grade bonds. Now, the main risk around this is that there is a maturity wall. Okay, so if you're listening to some of the biggest investors in the world, their number one concern right now, if you speak to them, is that in a rising interest rate environment that the US has been going through over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, as interest rates start to rise, these bonds, which are issued with a maturity date of maybe 5 years or 10 years, these bonds need to be refinanced at the end of that investment maturity period. And they'll be refinanced at the prevailing interest rate at the day in which they mature. Now, the concern is that right now we have a maturity wall that is, at the moment, we have about $93 billion worth of high-yield debt that is due to mature and be refinanced this financial or this calendar year in 2019. But in 2020, that jumps to $156 billion. Right. In 2021, it goes up to $200 billion. And in 2022, that goes to $315 billion. And from 2022 all the way through to 2026, you're averaging sort of around about $300 billion worth of high-yield debt that is due to mature and will need to be refinanced potentially at much higher interest rates than what they're currently being added to at the moment.
So how does the refinancing work? Does it mean that there's investors out there that, you know, obviously they need to be paid because it's their maturity and there's got to be another volume of new investors to take their place?
So typically a corporate borrowing tends to happen with a bond, okay? Yeah. And these bonds are essentially a loan to the company from investors. There is a coupon, an interest coupon attached to that bond. These might be issued at 100 cents in the dollar. And at the end of that maturity, that money needs to be repaid back to the investors at 100 cents in the dollar. It's a contractual obligation, and in between, they've got to be paying quarterly or half-yearly coupons back to the investors, interest coupons back to the investors. Now, these bonds can be bought and sold by other investors, by the investors during that maturity period, and the actual value of that bond will reflect the credit quality of those bonds at that point in time throughout the cycle. So you might find that a company who issues a bond at $100, if its operating environment deteriorates, that bond might sell off to 90 cents in the dollar. Because investors are now building in the fact that, you know, hey, there's a chance that these we might not be able to recoup the full 100 cents in the dollar. Okay. Or that when it comes to, you know, the maturity of that bond, that the company is going to have to refinance at a higher interest rate, and that's going to put pressure on that company to get funding or financing. So it is a risk, and it's a big risk to the economic cycle that we're currently going through at the moment, because these are traditionally the worst class of borrowers in the corporate in the corporate bond market.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do is just give clients a little bit of a and listeners a little bit of an understanding as to what the high yield bond market actually looks like, and just do a little bit of a temperature check in terms of how these companies are performing, what the level of gearing is, where the risks might be, and just where, you know, what we're looking at.
Okay.
In terms of just, you know, making sure that we're on top of it all. So this bond market was essentially, you know, led by and created by a gentleman called Michael Milken, who used to work for Drexel Burnham Lambert back in the 80s. And why would investors want to invest in these low quality credits when potentially these are the worst of the worst borrowers? Well, the reality is that the high yield bond market has actually produced better returns with less volatility than the equity markets over
really?
Time.
Wow.
If we just have a look at the last 10 years as an example, the high yield debt market has produced a total return of 13.8% over the last 10 years compared to global equities, which have generated a return of 12.1%.
Wow.
Per annum.
That is good.
Okay.
Now, the high yield debt market has done it with just volatility of 7.7%, when the equity markets have generated that 12.1% return with a 12.5% volatility.
Wow, okay.
So equity markets over the last 10 years have produced less returns with more volatility than what the high yield debt market has produced. So there's one reason why you may want to be an investor in high yield credit.
It's a good reason.
Yeah.
Now these a lot of people might think that these are smaller companies that really are not don't have meaningful businesses. Well, the reality is that the median company revenue in this market is around about $6.5 billion in
wow.
US dollar terms. $5.5 billion in US dollar terms. And the median company profits is around about $1 billion or $931 million in annual corporate profits. Mm. Now, the sorts of companies that fall into this area, you might be familiar with companies like Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Netflix is borrowing a lot of money at the moment because they're investing heavily into content, producing new content, original content. Virgin Mobile.
Mm. Right.
Okay. So Hertz.
Yeah.
Yum Brands, which owns
yes,
companies like KFC, Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, and Iron Mountain, the document storage company.
I think out of all those you've listed, Joel, I think I'll pay some sort of money to all of them.
So these are companies that we can be familiar with and understand, and they're yep. certainly not small businesses, but you know they do have some issues. Now, what we are seeing at the moment is that there was a huge surge in the issuance of these bonds between 2012 and 2006 through to 2014. But over the last few years, the bonds that have been issued are starting to taper off. Mm. Also, the improvement in the financial metrics of these companies is also improving as well. So a simple measure is total debt to earnings before interest, tax and depreciation, and that's now declining from what was previously a ratio of around about 4, and that's coming down to about 2.5. So these companies are actually improving their financial credit worthiness. And also, the earnings before interest and tax relative to their interest expense is increasing, meaning that their profits relative to their interest payments is increasing as well. So their ability to service this is improving. But the real risk that I see with this whole scenario is that US loans overall have been rising substantially, even though high yield debt as a proportion of those loans have been falling in the last few years, where we've seen US loans overall go from $650 billion up to $1.1 trillion.
Ooh, nearly double.
In just the last 6 years. And at the same time, the number of those loans that have been issued with covenant light loans, so these are loans where the lender is not requiring the borrower to meet certain standards. It might be things like, you know, making sure that you've got a certain amount of cash in the balance sheet,
yeah.
keeping your gearing ratios at reasonable levels. These loans have exploded in size while the credit underwriting quality has deteriorated,
mm-hmm.
okay? So if you're sort of taking a bit of a temperature test in terms of where the risks might be, at this point in time in the immediate future, you'd say 2019, 2020, looks pretty contained at this point in time. The risks start to become elevated around 2021, 2022, and that's where we would expect that if this cycle continues to increase, interest rates will also continue to increase, and the refinancing refinancings of these debts could become troublesome to the extension of this current cycle.
Yeah.
So it's one thing that we're monitoring at the moment. Be aware but not alarmed, or be alert but not alarmed.
Yep.
Just one thing to just sort of keep on the radar, and we'll keep updating investors in regards to how this is tracking and loan defaults in this space.
Within a portfolio that you manage for a client, are these bonds a significant portion, a small portion?
Sorry, in regards...
into a portfolio that you might manage for a client?
Oh, we don't tend to invest in these types of loans. Yeah, so they're not typically the sorts of things that we tend to invest in.
It's more a factor of the economy that you want to know about. You want to know if the broader market or the economy is going through a cycle where you have companies at risk of defaulting. There's two things. One is the risk of companies not being able to make their loan repayment or to refinance, because that would be a financial disaster for that particular company. Mm-hmm. And if it's happening to a lot of companies in the market, well, then it becomes a market issue or a systemic issue. Whereas the other potential factor is, well, if there's just a single company, well, then it affects that company's profits, but not the actual bond market itself.
Sure. Yeah. So there would be companies that would have these bonds on issue that you may have clients with that are shareholders of those companies, and you'd be monitoring that as well?
Well, typically not, because a lot of these companies have debt ratios that... we typically don't invest in companies that actually have any debt.
Okay.
Or they have very low levels of debt. But
very interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
That's great insight. Thanks, Joel. We're now going to throw to another quick break, and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back, everyone. And we're going to throw over to Louis, who's going to finish off with the seventh and final topic of how to sort your finances.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steph. So the last number of weeks, I've been talking about people who wanted to set a New Year's resolution of sorting out their finances. We've talked about how to monitor your income versus your expenses to recognize whether you're actually getting ahead or not. We've talked about ways to increase your income, reduce your expenses, restructure your debts. And what I spoke about yesterday was part one of two of trying to sort out your superannuation. The reason why it was part one of two is because you can't sort out your superannuation unless you have an understanding of your insurance position with life insurance and disability insurance. So when it comes to superannuation and sorting out your super, there's three factors that I look at in comparing one super fund against another. Firstly, what is the insurance benefits? And if you've done your homework from last week, well, then you've got that sorted out. The second and third things I look for are, what are the fees of your super fund? And what are the investment options and investment performance of that super fund? So for a lot of people, superannuation will end up being your second biggest asset, your biggest asset outside of your family home. So you need to pay serious attention, because a difference of returns or fees of even a small amount over a long period of time will have a huge impact. If you give it a long enough time, earning an extra 1% in returns will end up being double the amount of money in retirement. So it's a substantial amount of risk on a decision that many people just put off and don't really pay attention to. So what should you look for in a super fund? Any ideas?
Good performance.
Low fees.
Good performance, low fees. Steph?
Oh, a company that's not doing anything dodgy.
A super fund that's not mentioned in the Royal Commission.
That's it.
Yeah. That would be nice as well.
Serving vested interests.
Yep, absolutely. So what should you look at in your super fund? Well, you need to do a comparison. You need to compare your super fund with what are the alternative options. But in Australia, there are hundreds, literally hundreds of different super funds that you could choose from. Mm. So you could start researching and trying to trawl through all those different options, or you could come to an expert like us and we can do the research for you, because we've already done the research for you. So we have a number of super funds with good investment options that we recommend, because we believe they are the best of what you can do. But if you want to do it yourself, then what should you look for? Okay, so take your different super funds that you want to compare, and you want to look at what are the 3 and 5 year returns of that particular fund. And over a 5 year period of time, you've got a pretty good idea of how that super fund or investment option is going to perform over the long term. It's not a guarantee, but it's about as good as you can get to compare one investment's 5 year return against another.
Can I ask a tricky question here?
Yeah.
Is it a little bit like getting insurances? If you have a super fund, should you be swapping over if you see, you know, that it's in decline? Or, you know, should you be looking to swap your super fund over like insurance, like you do with insurance or phone bills or things like that? Or is it better, even if it's in a decline, to stick with
a
super fund?
Yeah, great question. Great question. A fast decline is not a warning sign in itself.
Okay.
And that's why you need to be a bit slow to make a decision to change. Mm. If you change your investment option based on the shorter term movements, then you will be making lots of changes over time. And those changes will be at exactly the wrong time to make the change. Mm.
You're essentially assuming that you're smarter than the average investor and you can pick the turning points if you take that approach. And history has shown that humans are pretty terrible at actually predicting major turning points.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. But how often should you be looking at a super fund and going, I really should change that? Like, I really, you know, really have to have a think about it, because it's, you know, it's not something that I'd ever really look at. Once I get into super, I think, oh, I'll leave it there.
Yeah.
You know, and as you said, even, you know, I think we spoke about this on the program a few weeks back, that people, even if it's a bad super fund, we don't tend to get out as quickly as what we should.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's very true. So I wouldn't suggest you leave it with one super fund for life.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even suggest leaving it with one super fund for a decade, but you want to keep an eye on that 5 year return.
Right.
So if the 5 year return of your super fund drops below the 5 year return of an alternative super fund, well, then you've given that super fund enough time. Even if you haven't been with them for 5 years, you can see what their 5 year performance has been.
Yeah.
And if that is lower than an alternative, well, then you can be pretty reasonably sure that the alternative option is better over the long term.
Mm, okay.
You might also want to speak with a professional around what strategically is going to be the right type of investment mix for you as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, different super funds have different investment mixes and different strategies and invest their money in different asset classes. You might want to also speak to a professional, or consider at least those mixes of assets within those investment options that you're investing in, and think about whether or not they're suitable for what you need going forward as well.
So it's also the stage of your life, you know, where you are, you should be taking into consideration that as well?
You should, yeah, absolutely. If you are more than 10 years away from retirement, then generally speaking, this is general advice, so not necessarily suitable for your personal needs and objectives.
Just put that disclaimer there,
Louis. Just put that disclaimer there. Seek financial advice for personal advice. But if you are more than 10 years away from retirement, then I'd be saying you should be going for the highest return.
Right.
Yep.
In fact, even if you're 5 years away from retirement, you should still be going for the highest return. If you are progressing in the years just before retirement, then you should be dialing back your investment mix with some defensive assets, which is expected to lower your return, but is also expected to provide some safety and security as you approach your retirement years, where you are drawing income out of your super fund.
Okay.
So that's what I would be suggesting there. You also want to have a look at the approach that the investment is using. So there's different investment philosophies out there. And there's broadly two schools of thought. There is the active investment school of thought, and there is the passive investment school of thought. Now, the active investment school of thought is saying, let's be active in the types of investments that we use. So if we like a particular company on the share market, let's buy it, and let's not buy other companies that we don't think are very good. The opposite is the passive approach, which is to say, let's just buy every company in the stock market. Let's buy, say, the top 50 or the top 100 companies as per their size. So the biggest companies on the share market, and let's just own them regardless of what they are or whether they're good or not.
Is that because they'll eventually sort of balance themselves out with good and bad stocks in the mix?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yep. There's good and bad stocks in the mix, and to invest passively is less expensive than investing actively.
Yep.
If you're just going to pick the top 200, it's pretty easy to do. You don't need a huge team of analysts, you don't need resources, you don't need a lot of research to do it. Mm-hmm. So the fees are lower, but are the returns any better? Now, my personal opinion is that an active approach sounds better. And it surely couldn't be too hard to look at the top 100 companies and then pick, well, that one's going to be in decline, that one's not a great performer, I can see the cycles turning on this one, and to exclude the few that are not as good. The problem is, though, Joel, how many active managers actually achieve their target return?
Very few. Usually there's only around about 25% actually outperform their benchmark after adjusting for the fees that they charge.
Yeah, wow. So you get 75% of these super funds or investment options that underperform their benchmark, which is why the passive investment approach is gaining a lot of traction in today's market. And there is a lot of so-called investment gurus, I call them life coaches, who are promoting the passive investment approach. And for your average punter, if you're making very broad decisions and doing it yourself, then you can do that.
And Louis, is that benchmark you mentioned basically in line with what a passive strategy would achieve?
Well, that's right. The passive strategy is just replicating the benchmark.
Right.
It's called an index fund, and it says, well, we're just going to have investments that replicate this theoretical index.
Yeah, basically, you've got those who know what they're doing, who go out there and do what they know.
Yep.
And they're the ones that actually consistently do outperform through the cycle.
They're the 25%.
They're the 25%. Then you've got those who don't know what they're doing, who probably are still investing as active managers and doing worse than the index.
Underperforming.
And then you've got those who understand what they don't know, and decide to invest in index funds.
Right.
Yep, exactly right.
So unless you can pick or know, have confidence that what you're dealing with one of those top 25%, you just go back to the passive strategy.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
And you know, the disclaimer always says, you know, history is not a dependable guide of future performance, historical return. But the reality is, it's probably the best
really the only
indicator of future performance, because if a fund manager is doing something that is consistently outperforming the market, they're probably doing something that's going to continue outperforming the market into the future.
Right, exactly. Must know something.
You know? Exactly. So it's no guarantee of future performance, but the reality is it's probably the best indicator of future performance.
Yes. Yep, that's right.
That's the saying we can use. Not a guarantee, but a good indicator.
Yep, exactly. Not a guarantee, but your best indicator. So here's a few things that I would point out as a final summary. First is, I would say active investment is the way to go if you know which options to choose. And those options to choose are out there. The second thing I would say is, if you are trying to do this comparison yourself, then the information should be easy to find. You should be able to find these investment returns just by phoning someone or seeing on their website. if it's difficult to find, it's because they're making it difficult to find because it doesn't look good.
Can I actually just mention something? I did this exercise yesterday, and I was looking for another fund to put in one of our services, a stock picking fund. And the first thing I did was I went to Google and I typed in best performing Australian share market funds. And then from there, a list of 10 fund managers popped up. And then from there, I just went to each of their websites and had a look at their historical returns, had a look at, and then from there, okay, that looked really good. They're not only just doing it over 12 months, but they're doing it over 5 and 10 years. And then I had a look at, okay, well, what's their selection process and what's their investment philosophy? Looking for great quality businesses that are cheap and blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, that makes sense. Great quality and buying it cheap, and it's, and you're showing that you can do that consistently through the cycle. Just by doing that simple, you know, hour of research, you're probably going to be doing better than 90% of other investors.
Yep. You know? Absolutely. Yeah. And that 1 hour of research, if you make a change to your super fund and you earn an extra 1 or 2% per year over the life of your super fund, you just made hundreds of thousands of dollars in that 1 hour of research.
That's a big impact.
It's a huge impact. Yeah. So if you're sorting out your finances, you got to sort out your super. You can't change your super fund until you understand your insurance position. So go back to last week's podcast. But then you need to do this research to look at, well, how's your super fund actually going to perform over the long term?
Yeah. Great advice, Louis.
Yeah.
All right. Well, to wrap up today's podcast, we're going to throw to our favourite session. You know what it is. You can't be serious.
You cannot be serious.
Who's got one for us today? Anyone want to start?
Well, I'll kick it off. In the theme of AFL football season starting, Western Bulldogs, give yourselves an uppercut. That jumper, that Thor jumper is horrendous. God, and if I was a Western Bulldogs supporter, I would be up in outroar and I'd be bringing in Zeus.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to put on the superhero because they're not going to make the finals.
No. Oh, my God.
I've got one from the USA, from the very cold state of Minnesota, which is covered in snow at the moment, as it is every winter. Someone called the police because they were worried about a person who was lying in the snow. But, of course, it was a bit strange. It was a person without warm clothing on hugging a pillow.
What?
And she thought, well, who is this deranged person? I'm not going to go and check myself because this person is probably crazy. Mm. So I'm going to call the police because I am concerned. So she called the police. Turned out it was a life-sized cardboard cutout.
Serious? Must have been a very, very large
one. Oh, my God.
Or bad eyesight.
Yeah.
So, guys, there's a saying in property investment that buy land because they're not making any more of it. As a bit of a philosophy.
Right.
But interestingly, the Times magazine has come out with some measurements to say that England should actually be bigger.
Really? How does that happen?
Okay, so they're actually saying that they should claim back some land from Wales.
What?
Due to a mountain surveyor that says the line between the two countries has been wrongly traced on the Ordnance Survey maps that date back to 1887.
Really?
I think they've got another whole bunch of problems that they should be worrying about at the moment.
That's right. Yeah.
But if they did do it, England would gain an extra 40-odd acres.
There you go.
We should go totally to war worth over it. That. Yeah.
Saves buying it.
That's right. Just annex it, hold a fake referendum, go Russia on Wales.
Yes, exactly.
All right, guys. Well, we'll have to wrap it up there today. But thanks again for all your input and to our listeners for tuning in. And if you're in Melbourne, please get along to the Grand Prix and have an enjoyable weekend. We'll see you all again next week.
Great stuff.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks a lot.
Watch your back.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.